So we stand about halfway through this chapter on the purified understanding, the third section in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge. Sri Aurobindo had been talking about the distinction between the higher buddhi and the lower buddhi, the higher buddhi which links us to a range of suprarational intelligence which can give us an averred true knowledge. Lift us out of doubt, make that the principal insight that drives intelligently our action in the world, so that in our thinking, in our feeling, in the conduct of our life's events, we can be attuned to the divine will. But we have to get there. He continues, we see then what we mean precisely by the understanding and by that higher faculty, which we may call, for the sake of convenience, the ideal faculty, and which stands to the developed intellect much in the same relation as that intellect stands to the half-animal reason of the undeveloped man. So he has talked about buddhi, the intelligent will of the Sankhya system, and that which the yoga practice and details that you'll read in the Yoga Sutras relies upon too. This Sankhyan system asserts a kind of intellect, a kind of insight, which is the highest point of the ratiocinate of mind. But Sri Aurobindo says that there is a higher range of this action of the buddhi. So this is what he refers to here, this ideal faculty. So this ideal faculty is what he wishes to flow into the rest of the being, all the elements of the prakritic nature ranging below. He continues, it becomes evident also what is the nature of the purification which is necessary before the understanding can fulfill rightly its part in the attainment of right knowledge. This purity is shuddhi. All impurity is a confusion of working, a departure from the Dharma, the just and inherently right action of things, which in that right action are pure and helpful to our perfection. And this departure is usually the result of an ignorant confusion of Dharmas, in which the function lends itself to the demand of other tendencies than those which are properly its own. He has a note here that this is Sankara, the mixing together of things, so that if each instrument followed its own natural way of holding to its truth, and Dharma comes from a root DHR with a dot under it, dhar, which means to hold tight, that if each element of the nature, the mind, if the vitality, if even the body, would stick to its own thing, follow its proper course of action, then we wouldn't arrive at this intermixture of things, which is one of the things that carries us away from true action and lands us into the foils of ignorance. Dharma, obviously, you know, is a word that has many, many connotations to it, but this seems to be the range in which Sri Aurobindo is using it here. The first cause of impurity in the understanding is the intermittence, the intermixture of desire in the thinking functions. And desire itself is an impurity of the will involved in the vital and emotional parts of our being. So desire may come from our vital region of being, but it has an impact upon the mind's course of action as well, and causes what he calls impurity here. There is a verse in the Yoga Sutras in the second chapter, second pada. I think it's the 28th. Through the performance of the members, the anga of yoga, and with the dwindling of impurity, ashuddhi, the radiance of knowledge, jnana, develops the vision of viveka, insight, discrimination, ability to see between the true and the false. So it is the practice of yoga that gives you that insight that leads to realization, to spiritual victory, to the state actually of yoga. So you practice yoga to get to yoga. You practice yoga as a harnessing of the being to be able to achieve yoga oneness. You yoke all the elements of your nature as you would horses on a team, and you drive them to their right destination where you achieve this grand unification of the being. When the vital and emotional desires interfere with the pure will to know, remember, buddhi means that. It is the intelligent will. When there's an upsurge from the lower prakriti, in other words, and it overcomes that first level of the buddhi, then the thought function becomes subservient to these waves of lower action. Pursues ends other than those proper to itself, and its perceptions are clogged and deranged. So let's read that sentence again. When the vital and emotional desires interfere with the pure will to know, the thought function becomes subservient to them, pursues other ends than those proper to itself, and its perceptions are clogged and deranged. So even this high point, this peak of intellection, which is the first level of buddhi, can get overwashed by the action from below. So, the understanding, he writes, must lift itself beyond the siege of desire and emotion, and in order that it may have perfect immunity, it must get the vital parts and the emotions themselves purified. The will to enjoy is proper to the vital being, but not the choice or the reaching after the enjoyment, which must be determined and acquired by higher functions. Therefore, the vital being must be trained to accept whatever gain or enjoyment comes to it in the right functioning of the life, in obedience to the working of the divine will, and to rid itself of craving and attachment. This is an aim that's very familiar to Western philosophers as well. Kant was always on a quest to try to still the physical and the vital demands in his own personal atmosphere so that he could live a life of pure reason. Can one do it simply with the power of the intellect? Similarly, he writes, the heart must be freed from subjection to the cravings of the life principle and the senses, and thus rid itself of the false emotions of fear, wrath, hatred, lust, etc., which constitute the chief impurity of the heart. Why are these false? Because they arise from the sense of separation, the sense of distinction, the sense of disjointment from that. I am here, that is larger, I resent it or I fear it, but it is other than my own being. Actually, the wise person, resting in the seat of the soul, sees all nature as a continuum. There is no distinction. There's differentiation, but there is no division, no cleft. It is one nature. The will to love is proper to the heart. But here also the choice in reaching after love have to be foregone or tranquilized, and the heart taught to love with depth and intensity indeed, but with a calm depth and a settled and equal, not a troubled and disordered intensity. The tranquilization and mastery of these members is the first condition for the immunity of the understanding from error, ignorance, and perversion. So the tranquilization, shama, in the footnote, shama is calm. The mastery, dhamma, control. This purification spells an entire equality of the nervous being and the heart. Equality, therefore, even as it was the first word of the path of works, so also is the first word of the path of knowledge. This takes us back to the Gita, 2nd chapter, 48th shloka, also 519, also chapter 12, 3 and 4, chapter 12, 13 and 14, and let's not forget chapter 10, 4 and 5. What he's speaking throughout all of this, getting rid of the impurity, is seizing upon and governing the nature with the higher consciousness. The higher elements must lean upon and enlighten and lift up the lower. Where force is necessary, they apply force. If reason and light are enough, well and good, on to the next stage, on to the next battle. So that's the first cause of impurity, ashuddhi, as it would be called in the Yoga Sutras. The second cause of impurity in the understanding is the illusion of the senses and the intermittence, intermingling, of the sense mind in the thinking functions. So the sense mind is again the manas, which gathers all the information, sensory reports, feelings, reactions to that, and brings them into a kind of model, which it then passes on to the buddhi for judgment. No knowledge can be true knowledge, which subjects itself to the senses or uses them otherwise than as first indices whose data have constantly to be corrected and overpassed. Sri Aurobindo, in his record of yoga, in many points, notes that the reports of the senses are prejudiced, that they have their own stories to tell, that they are not impartial witnesses, that they interpret even in the seizing of the data that which they should hand to the mind clear and unfiltered. So we have to regard the senses as a dubious source of knowledge, even of real information. Let us also note that in the system of the Sankhya, it is possible for the buddhi to know without reliance upon the lower members, that it can, simply through the force of its vision, come to know the activities of Prakriti. The beginning of science is the examination of the truths of the world force that underlie its apparent workings, such as our senses represent them to be. The beginning of philosophy is the examination of the principles of things which the senses mistranslate to us. The beginning of spiritual knowledge is the refusal to accept the limitations of the sense life, or to take the visible and sensible as anything more than phenomenon of the reality. So different grades of knowledge are possible to us. Science begins with the appearances, uses instruments that collect physical data. Philosophy looks to the inner reason of things. Spiritual knowledge, jnana, accepts none of this as verified, but looks through the power of identity into the thing before it and comes to know the essence of the reality and the form that results from that essence. Equally, must the sense mind be stilled and taught to leave the function of thought to the mind that judges and understands. So, if the lower buddhi has to learn its place, then manas has also to learn how to behave in its regulated fashion as appropriate for spiritual growth. Because if natural conduct is all that we're looking for, then we can let nature do what it wishes. It's when we wish to pull it back into obedience of a higher will, the higher law, when the intelligent will, buddhi as a higher power, wants to radiate itself through the lower chain of being and becoming, that this becomes at all an issue. It then reveals itself as a constantly swirling and eddying undercurrent of habitual concepts, associations, perceptions, desires without any real sequence, order, or principle of light. Here we're in the world of the sanskaras, of the vasanas. It is a constant repetition in a circle unintelligent and unfruitful. Ordinarily, the human understanding accepts this undercurrent and tries to reduce it to a partial order and sequence. But by so doing, it becomes itself subject to it and partakes of that disorder, restlessness, unintelligent subjection to habit, and blind, purposeless repetition, which makes the ordinary human reason a misleading, limited, and even frivolous and futile instrument. We are more led than leading when we become that. There is nothing to be done with this fickle, restless, violent, and disturbing factor but to get rid of it, whether by detaching it and then reducing it to stillness, or by giving it a concentration and singleness to the thought, by which it will of itself reject this alien and confusing element. So this demands from us a forceful yogic effort. This concentration, dharana, this singleness, ekagrata, the oneness, the unmoving focus, is how one can get free of it. A third cause of impurity has its source in the understanding itself and consists in an improper action of the will to know. Well, might be a good place here to interrupt the progress for a moment and see that what we're having to do is to teach our nature how to behave ordinated by spirit, and not according to its own compulsions and impulsions. And again, the Yoga Sutras seem to be a model to some extent of what Sri Aurobindo is shaping here, so we may as well look at them, at least in their early iterations in this second pada that we referred to, where Patanjali has described the yamas and the niyamas, the restraints and the injunctions that can lead us to control, to ethicize, to more enlighten our lives. And the first thing we do is learn how to control our nature, learn how to get a grip on it, literally, the yama. First with ahimsa, non-injury, try not to hurt another being. This first set, the yamas, have very much to do with how we deal with the outside world. How does our self interrelate with larger society, with larger nature? So ahimsa comes first. It's the first element, to not injure another. Satya, to speak only the truth. By restraining our action, by speaking truth, our actions become more and more true. Through asteya, through not stealing, not appropriating to oneself what doesn't belong to you. So this is one thing, not to recognize that sometimes we deliberately take an idea, rob some person of their energy, claim to our own domain what belongs in another. And then brahmacharya, which is literally the path that takes you to God. It means, most often, that we're trying to control our life energies, to give them a good, ordinated path, not to act in a way that roils society around us. We should pacify our own nature by regulating our passions. And then the last element, the last yama, is aparigraha, which becomes immediately relevant here, which is why I bring it up, which is non-grasping. Don't cling. Now, the other side of this, you can see that if we're not clinging, we're controlling our passions. We live without claiming the fruit of another's life. We speak the truth, and we work in a way that is non-injurious. We complement those with another set. Shocha, to live purely. And this doesn't mean physical purely. Surely everybody knows to bathe. Shocha means to keep your thoughts clean. It means to keep your heart high. Be lofty. When you are alone, don't slump in a chair. Sit nobly. Stand and walk gracefully. Santosha. Live in contentment with the things that are given to you. What is appropriate for you to have, what the Divine Mother has willed for you to be in charge of, is in your possession now or is on the way. What have you to worry about it? Take good care of that which is in your domain. Be content. Be happy. Find the soul of delight inside. Your happiness does not come from outside things. Tapas, work hard. Apply yourself. Swadhyaya, study yourself. Swadhyaya often means to the reader, I should read books and gain knowledge through books. Study yourself, study your thoughts, look like a witness, look as Purusha, as Sakshi, at your own nature. Become insightful as to how your mind works, how your heart churns up emotions, how your physicality operates. And as you study, you will see more and more that he, she who watches is not simply the mind or the life or the body, but is a deeper conscious being which surveys this. Ishvara. That innate relationship, which is cognate with the divine, which pulls you upwards, is the cause of your aspiration. You find your soul. You lean upon the power of your soul. It carries you upwards towards that. And pranidhana, the devotion to that which you perceive above, in knowledge, in love, and in action, fortifies your upward growth. So these are the opening elements, one which deals with the world and one which deals with our own internal processes. All of this in preparation. So now let's go back and look at this third cause of impurity, because this clinging is one of the things that we need to release. Aparigraha. A third cause of impurity has its source in the understanding itself and consists in an improper action of the will to know. That will is proper to the understanding, but here again, choice and unequal reaching after knowledge clog and distort. They lead to a partiality and attachment, which makes the intellect cling to certain ideas and opinions, with a more or less obstinate will to ignore the truth in other ideas and opinions, cling to certain fragments of the truth, and shy against the admission of other parts, which are yet necessary to its fullness, cling to certain predilections of knowledge, and repel all knowledge that does not agree with the personal temperament of thought which has been acquired by the past of the thinker. The remedy lies in a perfect equality of the mind, in the cultivation of an entire intellectual rectitude, and in the perfection of mental disinterestedness, where we can stand back. So that equality, Bhagavad Gita 2:48, and the purified understanding, as it will not lend itself to any desire or craving, so will not lend itself either to any predilection or distaste for any particular idea or truth, and will refuse to be attached even to those ideas of which it is the most certain, or to lay on them such an undue stress as is likely to disturb the balance of truth and depreciate the values of other elements of a complete and perfect knowledge. This purified understanding brings to us viveka, discrimination. An understanding thus purified would be a perfectly flexible, entire and faultless instrument of intellectual thought and being, free from the inferior sources of obstruction and distortion, would be capable of as true and complete a perception of the truths of the self and the universe as the intellect can attain. but for real knowledge, something more is necessary. Since real knowledge is, by our very definition of it, supra-intellectual, in order that the understanding may not interfere with our attainment to real knowledge, we have to reach to that something more and cultivate a power exceedingly difficult for the active intellectual thinker and distasteful to his proclivities, the power of intellectual passivity. In the Yoga Sutras, this is Hana, chapter 2, verse 26. The object served is double, and therefore two different kinds of passivity have to be acquired. In the first place, we have seen that intellectual thought is in itself inadequate and is not the highest thinking. The highest is that which comes through the intuitive mind and from the supramental faculty. Note that in this passage, untouched by Sri Aurobindo when he was revising some of the other chapters, there is missing the inclusion of the stage of overmind. Because as he wrote this in 1916, that distinction was not yet clear to him. He had to climb and climb until finally he reached what he thought was the Vijnana itself and discovered there, late teens, 1920, etc., that this was that bright lid described in the Isha Upanishad. That it was, in fact, the overmind that he was entering, not the supermind. And so he worked another half dozen years, didn't he, in preparing to bring that overmental luster into the cells of his body and into the physical earth itself. But here, he writes about the intuitive mind and the supramental faculty, without that bridging consciousness of overmind between. So long as we are dominated by the intellectual habit and by the lower workings, the intuitive mind can only send its messages to us subconsciously and subject to a distortion more or less entire before it reaches the conscious mind, or if it works consciously, then only with an inadequate rarity and a great imperfection in its functioning. This obviously is true whether or not we speak of the overmind. When any higher light comes down from above, it is often distorted by the medium in which it comes to rest. In order to strengthen the higher knowledge faculty in us, we have to effect the same separation between the intuitive and intellectual elements of our thought as we have already effected between the understanding and the sense mind. And this is no easy task, for not only do our intuitions come to us encrusted in the intellectual action, but there are a great number of mental workings which masquerade and ape the appearances of the higher faculty. So not only does the intuition descend and get mixed in the formations of the mind, but the mind says, aha, I can do that too, and tries to create its own illuminations, which it would brand as intuition. The first remedy is to train first the intellect to recognize the true intuition, to distinguish it from the false, and then to accustom it, when it arrives, at an intellectual perception or conclusion, to attach no final value to it, but rather look upward, refer all to the divine principle, and wait in as complete a silence as it can command for the light from above. One can only do that fully when one is familiar with, in conversation with, the heights beyond the mind. But if we don't begin to climb, if we don't begin to experience, we never do get to the realization. But this is a great practical distinction of the highest order here. And this is in contrast with trying to still the mind from the intellectual level. Read again what he says. Look upward, refer all to the divine principle, and wait in silence for the light from above. Rather than wrestle with the thought activities and the impurities in the mind at its own level, rather than trying to kill the ego where the ego exists, rather than trying to bring peace to the mind from the level of the mind, one has to instead reverse, receive, be irradiated from above. It is not your conquest, it is your surrender that permits the confluence of the divine light and energy here in you. In this way, it is possible to transmute a great part of our intellectual thinking into the luminous truth-conscious vision. The ideal would be a complete transition, or at least to increase greatly the frequency, purity, and conscious force of the ideal knowledge working behind the intellect. The latter must learn to be subject and passive to the ideal faculty. Again, receptive. But for the knowledge of the self, it is necessary to have the power of a complete intellectual passivity, the power of dismissing all thought, the power of the mind to think not at all, which the Gita in one passage enjoins. We've offered references. This is a hard saying for the occidental mind, to which thought is the highest thing, and which will be apt to mistake the power of the mind not to think, its complete silence for the incapacity of thought. A la Russell, Whitehead. You're familiar with Russell's report of his single attempt at meditation when he decided to leave the vacuities of the outer mind where he had a kind of brilliance and looked inside himself. He saw only darkness and gave it up. But this power of silence is a capacity and not an incapacity, a power and not a weakness. He would later write in Savitri, "In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power." Only when the mind is thus entirely still, like clear, motionless, and level water, in a perfect purity and peace of the whole being, and the soul transcends thought, can the self, which exceeds and originates all activities and becomings, the silence from which all words are born, the absolute of which all relativities are partial reflections, manifest itself in the pure essence of our being. In a complete silence only is the silence heard. In a pure peace only is its being revealed. Therefore, to us, the name of that is the silence and the peace. And so we say, Shanti, 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 three times. Peace to the mind, peace to the heart, peace to the body. As I have heard my dear Vasanti say. So, I think we're going to read from Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 6, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. This begins on page 183. A consciousness lit by a truth above was felt. It saw the light, but not the truth. It caught the idea and built from it a world. It made an image there and called it God. Yet something true and inward harbored there. The beings of that world of greater life, tenants of a larger air and freer space, live not by the body or in outward things. A deeper living was their seat of self. In that intense domain of intimacy, objects dwell as companions of the soul. The body's actions are a minor script, the surface rendering of a life within. All forces are life's retinue in that world, and thought and body as her handmaids move. The universal widenesses give her room. All feel the cosmic movement in their acts and are the instruments of her cosmic might. Or their own self, they make their universe. In all who have risen to a greater life, a voice of unborn things whispers to the ear, to their eyes visited by some high sunlight. Aspiration shows the image of a crown. To work out a seed that she has thrown within, to achieve her power in them, her creatures live. Each is a greatness growing towards the heights, or from his inner center oceans out. Encircling ripples of concentric power, they swallow glutted their environment. Even of that largeness many a cabin make. In narrower breadths and briefer vistas pent, they live content with some small greatness won. To rule the little empire of themselves, to be a figure in their private world and make the milieu's joys and griefs their own, and satisfy their life motives and life wants, is charge enough and office for this strength, a steward of the person and his fate. This was transition line and starting point, a first immigration into heavenliness for all who cross into that brilliant sphere. These are the kinsmen of our earthly race. This region borders on our mortal state. Now let's turn to Canto 13 in the Self of Mind. This begins on page 283. At last there came a bare, indifferent sky, where silence listened to the cosmic voice, but answered nothing to a million calls. The soul's endless question met with no response. An abrupt conclusion ended eager hopes, a deep cessation in a mighty calm, a finest line on the last page of thought, and a margin and a blank of wordless peace. There paused the climbing hierarchy of worlds. He stood on a wide arc of summit space, alone with an enormous self of mind, which held all life in a corner of its vasts. Omnipotent, immobile, and aloof, in the world which sprang from it, it took no part. It gave no heed to the paeans of victory. It was indifferent to its own defeats. It heard the cry of grief and made no sign. Impartial fell its gaze on evil and good. It saw destruction come and did not move. An equal cause of things, a lonely seer and master of its multitude of forms, it acted not, but bore all thoughts and deeds, the witness Lord of nature's myriad acts, consenting to the movements of her force. His mind reflected this vast quietism. This witness hush is the thinker's secret base. Hidden in silent depths, the word is formed. From hidden silences, the act is born into the voiceful mind, the laboring world. In secrecy wraps the seed the eternal sows. Silence, the mystic birthplace of the soul. In God's supreme, withdrawn, and timeless hush, a seeing self and potent energy met. The silence knew itself, and thought took form. Self made from the dual power, creation rose. In the still self, he lived, and it in him. Its mute, immemorable listening depths, its vastness and its stillness were his own. One being with it, he grew wide, powerful, free. Apart, unbound, he looked on all things done. As one who builds his own imagined scenes and loses not himself in what he sees, spectator of a drama self-conceived, he looked on the world and watched its motive thoughts with the burden of luminous prophecy in their eyes, its forces with their feet of wind and fire arisen from the dumbness in his soul. All now he seemed to understand and know. Desire came not, nor any gust of will. The great perturbed inquirer lost his task. Nothing was asked, nor wanted any more. There he could stay, the self, the silence one. His soul had peace. It knew the cosmic whole. Namaste. Jai Ma.